You're listening to the Pulled by the Root podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at www.pulledbytheroot.com.
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Heidi Marble. The sun finally came out in our area in the Northwest, and I am so happy to be here with two amazing women. My co-host, Amy Hansen. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Heidi. Hi, Monica.
So nice to see you today. And our guest today is Monica Hall. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
Monica, it's been so great just having the chance to really dive into your writing, get to know you a little bit on the phone. So I'm really excited to introduce you to our guests. I know that you're out there a lot, but hopefully we're going to have a really interesting conversation. People are going to learn a lot more about you. I'd like to read your bio first. Monica Hall is an adoptee and birth mother. She is also the author of her memoir, Practically Still a Virgin. Born in Canada, she was adopted by American parents and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, where she spent the first 16 years of her life and had many of the foundational experiences that drive her writing. She is a business consultant and entrepreneur who has founded several companies and has worked in advertising and marketing for more than two decades. Monica is telling her life story to provide understanding, courage, and empowerment, showing that no matter the difficulties, it's possible to heal and succeed. Monica is a speaker, coach, and mentor. She has three grown children and lives in Sacramento, California. Okay, Monica, so I dove into your blog and I found Knee Deep in Drama, AKA Trauma Survivor. And that was the first thing that really stuck out to me. And right. If you don't mind, can I read the first thing you said? It's so great.
Sure.
We've all known people who go on and on about the drama in their lives, aka trauma survivor. Getting so wound up about talking about it, it makes you wish you could pole vault into another state. I don't ever want to be that person. Unfortunately, I have been that person. Oh my gosh, Monica, I can relate. Here's the thing though, Monica. You have been through a lot of trauma. And I think, it's really hard when we've been through so much for that not to be the most forward thing on our mind and the thing that we're thinking about. Can you talk a little bit about that statement, maybe where it came from, just some of your general feelings about the drama and the trauma?
Sure. Anyway, thank you for having me, by the way. It's an honor. So I love that you read my blog, because when I started writing my memoir in 2016, you know, I didn't know it was going to take me 7 or 8 years to do so. But as things started coming up, I needed to valve release. You know, it's like I had to just let go of something. So I started posting these essays on my blog, and I have a very long story, and this memoir, Practically Still a Virgin, is mostly about the adoption and how that came about and how I got pregnant and, you know, a lot of dysfunction, family stuff. But there was a lot of other stuff that I didn't get to cover, but I wrote it. I wrote so much. I mean, I wrote everything. I mean, I've had lots of things that aren't going to probably be both books. But this particular one was when there are some things that happened to me during the oil boom times in Alaska. And one of which I was abducted at knife point, and I was 15. And as you can imagine, I mean, I did escape. I'm still here, and it was absolutely terrifying. But what I was going through at the time is I became obsessed with knowing who that was. Now this, you know, was, 1972. So the chances are that this older person that abducted me is even still alive were slim. And I found some really dark stuff about what had happened in Alaska, what was going on, and what was going to happen to me. And I mean, I was going through it when I saw this lady in the cafe, a lady that I had known previously, couldn't put my finger on what about her bugged me. But, and I think if you read the rest of that, you would see that, you know, I'd forgotten that I didn't like her. Yet I like just kind of spewed all this stuff over. She asked how I was doing. I mean, if you don't want to know, don't talk to me. I mean, you should have seen the look on her face. It was kind of one of like terror, like, oh God, I got to get out of here, right? And
Right.
it was, I mean, when I noticed it, because I was on her roll, when I noticed it, I shrunk back. I'm like, oh crap. When I was just that person, you know? So.
And I think this is key, Monica, as far as pr progress and healing is self-awareness. So this is how you end this essay, or I know that self-awareness is a good thing. As I write and revise, I peel back the flaky skin of the onion to reveal what may turn out to be a sweeter onion, like those Vidalia onions you can eat raw, the onions that don't make you cry when you chop them up and put them in a quesadilla you're about to eat because your now adult daughter has put you on a diet to help you lose the 20 pounds you've gained while writing your memoir. And the only things left in your fridge are two corn tortillas and some Parmesan cheese and maybe an onion. Okay, first of all, I laughed so hard when I read that because we do talk about the layers of the onion, and thank you so much for that humor break in all of the seriousness, because it is that peeling back and self-awareness that is, I think, so powerful that when we can stop ourselves and say, oh man, maybe I'm not reading the room. And I love produce too, so let's talk about
I
it.
forgot I wrote that. That's great. Thank you for reading.
It was really good, Monica, really good. So I want to segue now into more of the details of your story because, oh my goodness, what you've been through and the beautiful, radiant person I'm sitting in front of, it's just hard to imagine. So let's take you back to when you're 15. You get raped at 15. I mean, let's just dive right in there. And can you tell us, share what that was like for you and what happened during that time?
Yes, absolutely. So I had such low self-worth, and I didn't have any identity. And I don't know if that was all because of being adopted or just how I landed here on the planet or how my destiny or my childhood. I don't really know. I do know that there was a lot of things that happened up until this point. And one is that my dad was attracted to me in a way that he shouldn't have been. And I felt really creepy around him. And, some things were said and I had repressed memories. And so I didn't have boundaries. I didn't know. I just wanted someone to like me and think I was cool. Now, I was my best friend. So I didn't do well in school. I had a it's crazy because I just got a review on my book by somebody who went to Stanford. And she read my manuscript. She goes, "Wow, you're a great writer. Where did you go to school? I don't see in your memoir that you went to college." I mean, she was asking me all these questions. I'm like, "No, I never did." And I didn't. I mean, I just couldn't. I couldn't focus in school. I had eight, probably ADD. I felt like the stupidest kid in class. So my self-esteem was low. I didn't fit with the kids in class that were smart, and I wished I did. I mean, I wished I was like them, you know. And then I had, a really dark house in terms of it wasn't real happy. There wasn't, people didn't come over and visit. And my mother was overprotective, and like I said, my father was a perv. And so I just wanted to have people like me, and I ended up figuring out by a series of events that are in my manuscript that and I think it was a subconscious choice. I don't remember consciously making the decision to be bad, but I thought I'd be good if I was bad, like somebody would look up to me. And in revision in the manuscript, I worked with a developmental editor, and basically that's how I learned to write. She would send manuscript back or these essays back, show, don't tell. What do you mean here? What do you mean you felt shamed? What shame? And I mean, I had to dig this stuff out because how I deal with on how I've dealt with pain is by pushing it down. Like I just push it down. And so that's what I had learned to do as a kid. And then when I decided I was going to be a bad kid, and then I'd have some friends that would look up to me because I'd be the baddest kid. And at that, a virgin, because we were Catholic and I was named after the Virgin, and there was this really weird Madonna thing with my family. And so I thought, you know, I'd be somebody. And so my best friend, who had a really, you know, lower class, we were middle class, they were barely paid their rent, lots of kids, alcoholic parents, you know, brothers, you know, were carrying knives and guns and things like that. And I really looked up to her big brothers because they were the baddest kids in the neighborhood. And so I knew these kids for about 3 years, and I was just a kid sister to her brothers, you know, and it was great, you know. They didn't really let us hang around with them or anything, but they had it like a crew of bad boys, and one of the boys took a an attention, gave me some attention when I was 15. And I'd been high on Reds. And I think that, you know, Reds were a downer that make you feel drunk. And I'd only taken them one time, and I never drank alcohol. And I didn't realize, but I was like giddy and, you know, that, you know, the kind that, oh, let me help you, young lady. And so he came on to me, and I never had anybody talk to me like I was a beautiful woman. I was a 15-year-old girl, and he was a 19-year-old, very, you know, man. And so I, through a series of events, I got raped, and never told anybody about it. And I felt like it was my fault. And I lost my identity right there. I was the badass virgin, Monica Hall, and I ended up, you know, I felt it was my fault because I didn't get black eyes and bloody lips, and I didn't, you know, protest enough, and you know, all those things we tell ourselves. And then I lost my claim to fame, my virginity. I don't know if anybody knew I was a virgin. I'm pretty sure they did, but I mean, he did. He was out to get virgins. That was his thing. And so you know, I have a very strict Catholic family, and through another series of events, my mother told me I was pregnant. And back then, this was 1973, and I was locked away for 6 months. And so I did, you know, my mother did about, you know, near the end of my pregnancy, she got me journals. I mean, it was Alaska on the shortest day is 5 hours long. So in the winter, it's dark and you hunker down. And, you know, I couldn't go to the store. I couldn't go anywhere. And if we did go somewhere, I had to get in the car through the garage. And then I'd sit in the parking lot while they went grocery shopping or, you know, come on. And I'm an extrovert. And, you know, usually introverts or people that are, they're writers. Extroverts aren't writers. We're talkers. For me to write's been really hard. I mean, this is not my first language is writing at all. It's like the ninth. And so for me to have all my friends abandon me, and, you know, what I want to say about that is I've had mentors over the years. And like I said, I'm 40 years sober in March. And one of the women that was working with me early on said, seemingly bad. It's only seemingly bad. Like when something bad happens, even today, it's only seemingly bad. Like I'm always looking for the silver lining. And I think that's how I've reframed things so that I can deal with them. And how I reframed that is that, we didn't in my Catholic family, there was no discussion about, okay, well, what are our options? And none of those things. And in fact, my editor kept asking me, can you show a scene where there was a conversation, you know, what you're going to do, you know, about the pregnancy? And there was never a scene. At least if there were, I don't remember. It was just, you know, you get pregnant, you give your baby away. There, that's it. You know, and Roe versus Wade had already passed in Alaska, but we were Catholic. That was never a consideration for me or my parents. But, you know, being pregnant at 15 and having been a virgin, and I mean, I was very naive about sex. I didn't even think I could get pregnant that way the first time, you know. But, you know, like the seemingly bad was, you know, I couldn't stop breaking into houses. I couldn't stop criminal behavior. I was a little hoodlum. You know, I break into houses and I vandalize and I beat people up. And I was a terror at school and I snuck out my window on the regular, took psychedelics. And I know today that what I was doing is that was my survival strategy. You know, I had to feel so I didn't have to feel. You know what I mean? I had to have my hair on fire so that I didn't have to feel the stuff that was really that I was pushing down all the time, pushing down, pushing down, pushing down. And so when I, and there was a period where I broke in with another girlfriend, different girlfriend than Kelly, into a friend's house while they were camping. And we, you know, there was big lollipops on the wall that we, you know, walked down the street sucking on, like really stupid. I think I, you know, made a bologna sandwich out of the fridge and stole his sister's babysitting money, and I had no qualms about it, like no guilt, no nothing. Like, was there a psychopathic behavior? I don't know. But I remember my mom once, she caught me in a lie. And she looked at me and the terror in her eyes, like, oh my God, she's a psychopath. You can look at me and lie and not. And, you know, I think maybe I was. I don't know. Maybe it was just a hurt kid, you know? So when I saw that the girl that I stole her babysitting money out of her Band-Aid tin that was in her nightstand, saw her at the corner store and, you know, oh gosh, I feel so sorry. I heard you start your house got ripped off. Gosh, did they catch him? You know, just such a phony little thing. And she goes, no, but they think they knew who did it. They just don't have enough evidence to take prints. And I swear, I thought I had been kicked in the chest because I knew, they knew it was me. And I knew I couldn't stop. And I knew I was going to get caught. That could have been my path. That wasn't my path. My path was to get knocked up and locked up in the house with my Catholic mother for 6 months, go to pray the rosary, write in a journal, become good. That was my, not that I became good, but yeah, I mean, I stopped sneaking out. I stopped all that. I stopped smoking right away as soon as I got pregnant. And that was a beautiful gift for me, you know, like these things that happen, I've been able to see the silver lining. And I believe this is my take on my life, that everything that's happened has been a gift for me to grow and to be closer to whatever that is, you know, if it's love or if it's oneness or it's God, or if it's, I don't know, but it's in my heart, it's love. Like I feel genuine love and gratitude for people and myself, which is insane because I had such self-loathing for years. And, you know, I don't think I'd have gotten there if I was getting my way.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Monica. And thank you so much for walking us through that painful journey that you went through as such a young girl. I just can't imagine being adopted and then being in that scenario. And
Yeah,
it just had to be really, really hard. And
it was a completely different experience because it was my daughter that I was gave birth to. She was my only known relative, the only person on the planet that was part of me. And I did, you know, groom the nun to let me see her. And I did get to hold her and see her and check her, you know, little fingers or smell her and all that stuff. And then I left the hospital with my mom. And yeah, my world went dark. It was very dark. My 16th birthday was so depressing. in my book, there's a picture of me cutting my cake. It was probably one of the worst days of my life. You know, sweet 16 and never been kissed. Ha, I wrote in my journal. And, you know, like everybody knows a 16-year-old girl that's just given birth has been kissed. And it was dark and gray and gloomy in July in Alaska, and nobody wanted to come over, have cake. And, you know, my baby was just less than a month old. And, you know, it was just an awful, awful time. But from that, you know, unless you, and like for me, unless I feel absolute grief and pain, I don't experience the joy when the joy's there. It's like you have to have the darkness to see to feel the light. Like, so there, I do experience not just happiness, but joy, like real joy today, you know? So, right? Maybe that was supposed to happen, seemingly bad.
Well, and I think this is a perfect segue. Before I segue, though, Amy, are there any questions you have? Anything?
No,
So,
thanks for sharing.
yeah, I just would like to, if we could just go forward to when you were reunited with your daughter. I think that would be a great way to wrap up this part.
Yeah, so I counted the years literally because that's the only thing I had to hold on to was 18 years. And so I would tell everybody, you know, especially when everybody knew about her. I mean, I knew she was just going to look just like me. She's going to talk just like me. She's going to walk. She's going to be just like me. She's going to be just like me. I don't know if because I believe that I created that, you know, thoughts or things or what. But so I, about 6 months before she was going to turn 18, I, you know, started telling everybody. I mean, you know, she's going to be 18 in 6 months. I'm going to look her up. And people started pushing back. Well, maybe you should wait. What if she doesn't want to find you? And I couldn't fathom that. First of all, she's just like me. I wanted to find my family. I found my family. She's going to want to find me as much as I want to find her. And so, you know, I was pretty angry at those people. And I couldn't wait. So I called the adopt. So we in 1974, about 9 months after she was born, we moved to California, where we live now, in the Sacramento area. And so I was living in California and I was at my desk at work and I called the adoption agency up in Anchorage, Catholic Charities. And the nun that had facilitated the adoption wasn't there anymore. She was in New York. But I said I'd relinquished a child, a daughter. We use the term give up. That's the terminology that I grew up with. You know, I gave up my baby for adoption and she's going to be 18 in 6 months, and I wanted to call, you know, just to get things rolling. And they said, and I'm, you know, actually adoption was open in Alaska at that time, believe it or not. And this was 1991. And they said, well, what you need to do is write us a letter and write a letter to her parents, and you know, we'll send it to them. And if they're open to it, we'll facilitate the adoption. So even when she turned 18, I wasn't going to get access to her through them, according to what she told me, unless they liked what I wrote. And I felt like I couldn't even, and this is a caveat too, because when I was pregnant with her, the nun, Sister Claire, she told me that I could write my daughter a letter that she could keep from her birth mother. And my mom got me started on a piece of paper. She wrote a couple examples. I still have them. And I couldn't write that letter. I could not write that letter. Everything that I thought to write, well, I couldn't keep you because you need two parents. All the shit that I heard growing up, you know, you need two parents and I love you, but you need the best, you know, all that stuff. They were bunk platitudes that I just couldn't put on paper. And in addition, I knew that anything I would write wouldn't have enough depth, and I felt stupid, and I didn't want them to see how stupid I was. Out of my shame, I didn't write the letter to her, even though there was nothing more in the entire universe that I would have wanted than a letter from my birth mother. And even then, because of my shame was so great that I couldn't write her that letter. And I still get choked up about it, you know? And I did write the letter. I wrote it in my memoir. So I got to do that letter, you know, and And I read it to her and she cried. But so I was supposed to write the letter and I didn't. And so here I had to write this other letter, to the parents of all people, these, and they always felt superior to me. They were better than me. They had money, they were, two people, a mother and a father. They were probably sophisticated. The father was supposed to have this big prestigious job and the mother stayed home. And, I just had such low self-worth and self-esteem that, and even today, the elevation between birth parents and adoptive parents, there's a definite, it's not balanced. And so I wrote that letter that night. I wrote that letter that night, and I have the copies of the letter. They're in my manuscript, and I don't think I went over them much. I just sent that damn letter. I want to see my girl, And so I sent it to the adoption agency, and then they wrote me back, the parents, and she wrote me back. But they did tell me, so that this is another caveat. Let me go back. So she told me, you write the letter, but wait 6 months until she's 18. Because, she wasn't 18 yet. And so I didn't write the letter. 2 weeks later, I get a call from Catholic Charities saying they have a picture. And I'm like, oh, what? A picture of who? Your daughter. She called within a few days of my call because they couldn't wait either.
That's
Seriously.
amazing, Monica. That's
Seriously.
amazing.
Oh
So,
my
did
God.
you see the picture of her before you saw her?
Yeah, so I go, I mean, I was this was back. I was working in an office and I couldn't wait because she lived in the Midwest. They wouldn't tell me where. So I was faxing and Federal Expressing the letters to Catholic Charities in Alaska, and then they were promised to Federal Express them to her parents so that it, because and my daughter has she can't wait either. We are instant gratification girls, So they I knew that the letter was the picture was coming in the mail. And so I kept calling my neighbor, is the mail come? Is the mail come? Is the mail come? It was like a 20-minute drive from work. And finally the mail had arrived and I drive home and I get on my sunlit porch and I open this little envelope and I pull out this picture and oh my God, it looked like I was looking at me. It was the weirdest feeling in the world to see somebody that she looked so familiar. She looked like somebody I knew. She looked like me. It was, and our hair, I have blonde hair now, and so does she, but we have dark hair. And at the time, it was perms, we had perms back then because that was the 90s, and we both had dark perms, So, wow, it was amazing. It was so amazing.
Oh gosh, Monica, it's just such a beautiful, not ending, but beginning to your story with your daughter to be able to have that experience. And like you said, that is the silver lining. It's a powerful experience for adopted people. I don't think the normal population really appreciates the fact that they can look here and look there and see themselves.
They don't. And this is what is frustrating for me. So I have a really good friend and she's helped me with some of the writing at the very end of this manuscript. And she had a really rough childhood. Her mother was an addict. She was basically, couch surfing. And I think her mother committed suicide when she was very young. And so we were writing. I mean, I don't remember what she was helping me with. And I said, but you don't get it. You don't have that woman. She snapped at me. She goes, yes, I do. I didn't have a mother. And I'm like, you don't get it. You don't get it. You had cousins. You had siblings. You had a grandmother. You had people that looked like you. You had identity because you could look at them and you could see the identity. I didn't have that. And I can't describe it for you because you can't know it or feel it unless you've experienced it. It
Amen.
is like, I cannot explain to somebody what it feels like to be a gay man because I've never been a gay man. I
That's so
can't
true.
explain. We can't. And it's, I wish I could just take that feeling that I had growing up that I couldn't identify, that I had no identity. Like, I wish I could take that feeling and pull it out of my heart and throw it in the people's hearts that don't get it. And if they just felt it for a second, they go, oh, that's the problem with adoption or with adoptees. It's not like adoption's a bad thing, but the ramifications that it causes people that have been relinquished is it's primal. It is a hole. It's a hole. And my daughter has that hole.
You could not have said that more beautifully. That is it. We really want people to understand, and we understand, but getting society to understand, maybe friends and family that are close to us that love us to understand. And this brings me to just this beautiful scene that you wrote about, Monica, when you talk about, all the missing pieces of the adoptee. And there was a scene when you went on a pilgrimage with your children and your daughter that you found, if I'm not mistaken. And I think people would love to hear. I stood in the middle of the meadow that July afternoon, surrounded by birch, alder, and poplar trees amongst the tall, translucent blades of grass as they waved in the breeze. It was as if my ancestors were welcoming me home. In the middle of the clearing were old well and the dilapidated home that had once been a place of music, dancing, and laughter. I collected the pieces of the flowered linoleum that my ancestors had danced on and the scraps of wallpaper that whispered their songs. I also collected pieces of wood from the house and the wild flowers from the land. I later pressed them between pages of a book about the area's history. That day in the warm summer breeze, I don't know if I'm going to get through this. I stood perfectly still while the meadow's fresh scent kissed my face and enveloped me in the perfect moment. The sound of my children, my granddaughter's laughter as they bounded through the tall grass filled me with peace. All the missing parts were in one place. I knew I was finally at home. I was complete.
Wow, I've got choked up too. I forgot
Yeah,
I wrote
you wrote
that.
that, Monica.
Wow, that's some good shit.
It is some good shit. I think that speaks to, and Amy, I think you and I've had conversations on this side too. There's so much pain, but there are also these beautiful moments when things just come together and we do not take it for granted. And you eloquently wrote about that. I felt you. I was there with you. I could see it. It's just. It was just absolutely beautiful. All right. So I think we need to talk about your brilliant attitude and the healing that has taken place in your life because you are an overcomer, if there ever was one. You talk about your sobriety. What are some things that you would want our community to know? Because a lot of them are struggling with the same issues. Just, when you were saying it was like you had to be bad to fit in and
I'm gonna take a deep breath. It's been a really long journey. So I started that when I got sober, and I had a I was 26. It had gotten very dark. My daughter, my drinking really went off the rails about the time my dad passed away, when I was 19. And that's and I had, I love my dad. I love both my parents. They did the best they could with the tools they had. And if you compare that to a healthy family, they didn't do very well. But they did the best they could. And it took me it interesting. And moms always get the shaft, It's like we always get the brunt. It's like, and my mom, I had the healing that I had to do in this last couple of years after she passed because I couldn't see her part in anything until she was gone because I loved her so much. And I just couldn't, my brain wouldn't go there, my emotions wouldn't go there. But when my dad's died, and I got introduced to Scotch, Black Label. And, you know, I had a fake ID and I was out looking for daddy in the bars, you know, lots of promiscuity, poor self-esteem, you know, just looking for someone to love me. And they wouldn't call the next day and lose my number. And it was a pretty dark time. And then I met somebody and we were married for about a month before he was cheating. But during that time I did the search and found my biological family in 1980. So that was back in the time when, before you had any internet, you had to write letters. Adoptee Liberty Movement Association, ELMA, helped me. I went to some meetings and they helped me build a binder. And I went to hear Florence Fisher speak in San Jose. And I'd forgotten about that. It was in my journal and my mother's, because she gave me her journals, you know, a few years ago. And so that was the beginning. And I stopped drinking when I was with him for a few years because I got liver disease, probably alcoholic hepatitis. I don't know. I was a binge drinker and, you know, I could handle my liquor. I could drink copious amounts of alcohol. And so once we divorced, because we were only married a month, and I found my family, I went up and to Canada and met them. And when I came back, it was on, you know, the alcoholism. And so, and the partying, cocaine, and, you know, companions got lower, the bars got danker, you know, I was fighting again in bars with women, you know, it just got really dark. And so it's interesting because for me, I can't heal until I surrender. And it doesn't matter if it's booze or alcohol or my adoption or any of the things, unless I surrender. I can't be in the way of the work. I can't be in the way. I have to let something greater than myself do it, you know? And I don't know what that is. I still don't know what that is. It's a feeling that I have in my heart today and it's not definable, but I've gotten there. And it came by having some real dark things happen. I got sober. I remember being in a blackout on the floor in a fetal position and sobbing, gut-wrenching sobbing. I had just taken a belt to my roommate while she was sleeping in bed. I don't remember it, I was told. And the next morning I called somebody that told me he would help me and introduce me to some people that could help me. And where I was is that I had such self-loathing. I hated myself so much that I couldn't stand to be alive another moment. And that is where I've had to go, not necessarily the self-loathing, but I've had to be at a place where I can't stand it another moment in order to be able to make a change. And that's different for everybody, but that's the way it works for me. I have to surrender. And so I did that. I did surrender. And of course, I like my hair on fire most of the time. So right away, I got knocked up by somebody else, some other guy. And I have a 39-year-old daughter who's wonderful. And she's sober, too. She's sober 13 years now. And we never went to jail. In fact, the daughter that I relinquished for adoption, we were reunited when she turned 18. The parents flew her out to see me and she had the same ism I did. And I took her to see me get a award for being a ward or whatever they do for being 10 years sober. And she went back to Michigan and got sober. And so she'll be sober 30 years in April. So, you know, my biological mother's father was an alcoholic. And he was the guy that I ended up looking like because my family's indigenous, but my grandfather was white. So, and so that's where it started. You know, I right away, I had problems, you know, I got knocked up, made him marry me and then we divorced and I raised a child on my own and I had to reach for help. I had to have community. And that's the thing that we have here now. And, I didn't have that. There was no adoption land back then. We have community today. That's what's so beautiful about having these podcasts, especially the ones that are about healing and what can we do to change the narrative here, rather than the big T trauma word all the time and, big victim thing, which is, easy to do because of the things we've gone through. I'm not the only one. I'm not, my the things that happened to me that seemingly seem so horrific, to somebody else, their divorce is as horrific as the things that have happened in my life. So, pain is pain regardless. And so I was on a healing journey, and it wasn't until, oh gosh, my daughter was a year or so old, and I was a little over a year sober, that I thought, I never cried about giving up Mary. I named her after me, Mary Monica. And I knew that couldn't be healthy, but I pushed it down. I thought about her every day, but I never cried because I knew if I did, I'd die because I'd never stop. You know what I mean? And so, I tried to read my journal, and I had stuffed it so much I couldn't access it, And I read my mom's journal because she was more, she could write better than me, and she it was more emotional, and I could feel the tears starting, and then they just slowly shut off. They were inaccessible. So I learned a lot of tools to get through that. And I think a lot of, for me, I had a lot of rage covering everything. My go-to was to be angry. And so I had a woman that mentored me, and she told me about hot penning. And I'll tell you that, I mean, I hated to write, but and I did it right in a journal the entire time, right? That I've intermittently written in a journal over the years. But that is, you take out a piece of paper and you grab a pen, pencil, whatever you have, and you just start writing. And it doesn't have to spell. You don't, it doesn't have to be legible. It doesn't have to make any sense. You just write, get it out. And that, we've got to have valve releases. We all, I mean, it can be about a fight with your boyfriend. It can be about, financial issues. It can be about, being abandoned, at birth. It can be many things, but I mean, I've had all these tools that I was able to employ. And you ask where the big healing come. And I've done a lot of things over the years. I've had past life regressions. I've had age hypnosis regressions. I've had gurus. I have been part of meditation groups. I have. I mean, I've done. I've prayed the rosary. I mean, ad infinitum. I've done it. I have a circle. I do some Native American spirituality. I've done a lot of things, and Course in Miracles. I mean, I just keep going, right? And the thing that's helped me more than anything is helping others. Period. Bar none. And if we could all do that, if we could all do that, think about when you get up in the morning and take some time for yourself, with your creator or whatever it is. And I there's some things that I say, like, what can I do today? What can I bring to to the world today? Or it can be as simple as, what can I bring to adoptees today? What can I bring to my family today? What can I bring to work, my employers today? And, my boss will call me, and he'll say, he knows that I go, what do you need? My job's to make you look good. My job's to make you happy. That's my job. And it takes that self-centeredness away, where we're always, cycling minds. That's the other thing. We have monkey minds. I hear it all the time, and from others, especially on other podcasts, that we're always thinking, and worrying. And what happens when we do that is we attract more of that. We attract more needs to worry. We attract more need to be angry. We attract, being resentful or being angry. And I do a lot of inventory work. Like, if I'm angry about something, I write it down. I look at it. I go over it with somebody, and I see where my part is, because I have a part in every resentment that I've ever had. Like, you're not going to be angry about it, because it's mine, So I've done a lot of different things like that, and I have practices that I employ, but bar none, it's working, it's helping others. So I'm pretty busy mentoring people. I'm pretty busy coaching people. I'm pretty busy, most of which I do for free. And this is the thing with the book. Okay. So my daughter was pregnant. My 39-year-old daughter was pregnant with my 7-year-old son, and she was over visiting, and she was leaving the house, and she goes, "Mom, I think you should write a memoir." I looked at her, I go, "What?" And because of the story, being adopted, finding your family, finding your daughter, and all that. And I had been carrying around these notebooks and these journals and these appointment books as early as 1968. And I intuitively knew that I was going to have to do this, even though I'd never written before. And so writing this, when I first started writing, I needed to figure out some of the stuff that happened to me. Like, there was missing, there was reoccurring dreams. There were things that I could not explain. There were phenomenon that I experienced now, or that I was experiencing, that didn't make sense. There was all kinds of stuff. There was mysteries that I needed to uncover, like who abducted me, and the rape situation that I'd never shared with somebody, anybody. So I had a lot of writing to do. And as I started writing, and some of the most painful, the first thing I wrote was the rape. And I felt guilty for it at 16. I mean, at 60, like, I was still feeling guilt, because I always had that child mentality that never changed. It was just sitting there. And once I got through all that and I got to the other side, there was a period where it was so dark, and I was probably about the onion part, when I was probably gained 30 pounds over this memoir, and at least. And I almost quit, because I thought, this is just not healthy. I'm going in a dark hole. I had some drinking dreams that I hadn't had in decades, and I kept at it, and it turned into a place where I knew I was writing for you. I was no longer writing for me. I was writing for you. And I get choked up, because I've gotten some reviews from, then I'll probably put on the book, from people that I really, really honor their opinion, and they're incredible, the things they say, and it's because it's touched them in a really deep place, a healing place, a place of compassion and identity, and it, I'm not alone, just, and there's hope, and there, all of that. And oh, man, it's cost a lot of money to write this book, but it's the best therapy. I swear to goodness. I mean, I all the trips back to Alaska, all the trips to Canada, all the editing, everything, and it's worth it. It was worth it. And so I want it to get in the hands of people that it can help. That's what I
Yeah,
want.
absolutely, Monica. And I have no doubt. I have no doubt. And I understand that process. It is brutal. And you're right. At some point, you have to understand, why am I doing this? And it isn't, our stories are not for us to keep. I mean, that's where the sharing is so powerful and important. Oh my gosh, this has been an incredible conversation. Amy, is there anything before we have our last comments?
Yeah, I actually really appreciate when you were talking about helping others is what is healing you. But when you discussed that, you talked about things you were feeling that you were bringing to people. So it seemed like you did a lot of your own soul searching. And within that soul searching, you were able to bring bits and pieces that you knew and you know in your book is really going to help others. And That's what we need. We need each other to share these really hard moments. So we know we're not alone. So we know we can get through it. And so we can validate things for each other. And it's really, I'm so excited for your book. So I'm waiting. We don't have too much more time to wait, but I'm really looking forward to being able to read it. And I really appreciate you sharing everything with us tonight.
Thank you. It'll probably be available when this airs. So,
Yes, I will try to coordinate it so that it does, because I think people need to get their hands on it right away. I can't wait to read it. Monica, is there any last things that you want to say to the beautiful audience listening all over the world? It's so crazy when we look at our analytics. I'm like, how are all these people? Thank you out there. We're so grateful.
I want to say that it doesn't matter where you are in your journey. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because you're going to get there. And this is the other thing. It's like I believe in destiny. I believe that we each have one, and it looks different for everyone. It's not something to be ashamed of if you're not doing this or doing that fast enough, or maybe you've backslid a bit in, the things that you feel are healthy for you. I mean, in my spiritual journey, I feel like I've got eternity to do, so get this right. So, just trying to do the best I can with the time I got here on Earth this time around, right? So, it's about being compassionate for ourselves, and that's the thing. We just got to let it happen when it's going to happen. And if it is going to happen, and that's part of the letting go process, letting the universal intelligence just take us where we're supposed to be going, when we're supposed to get there, so the judgment and the rush and the judgment of others, like, oh gosh, she's doing this and that and poor thing. No, it's perfect. It's just the way it's supposed to be. It's just perfect the way it is.
That's so good. And I love the idea of surrender. That is a very hard thing to do because it's vulnerability. And it is a difficult thing to be vulnerable with all of this history. Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Amy, for being here. And this was just, I know our audience is going to get so much out of this. They're going to feel the energy and the light that you bring. It's going to come across.
Oh, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to do this. It's lovely.
Absolutely. And you have to come back. We have to talk books again.
Oh, goody gumdrops, because there's
Okay.
goody gumdrops. I'm not
Okay.
dating myself. This, I sound like my mother. But
But
yes, when it comes out, oh my gosh, there'll be more to talk about.
oh, for sure. There's never enough time.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. We hope it meant something to you. Tell us your story, learn more about our mission, and support the podcast at www.pulledbytheroot.com.